It is the Business News Hour. You know, we've been afforded the opportunity to interview many of the candidates vying to become the 2020 presidential nominee of the Democratic Party. Today, we sit down with author Marianne Williamson, who's been working Iowa, New Hampshire, South Carolina, and any number of states in advance of the upcoming debates. I think you're going to find this one of the more insightful conversations you've heard about politics, the economy, business, and the direction of our nation. Marianne Williamson, coming up next on the Business News Hour. Insight on Business, the News Hour, is made possible through the support of Taro International. You know, for decades, Taro trainers have improved the business and personal lives of those who have learned more about communication skills, sales, personal branding, business etiquette, and more. Achieve, lead, and outclass with training from Taro International. That's TERO.com.
Insight on Business, the News Hour with Michael Libby is made possible through the support of AARP Iowa. Real possibilities for people of every age. AARP Iowa and Country Vet Naturals. Loved by pets, trusted by owners. CountryVetNaturals.com.
Welcome back to the Business News Hour. Grateful that you have clicked through again today. We are sitting with presidential candidate Marianne Williamson. And Marianne has been stumping in the state of Iowa over the past several months, as a matter of fact, and launching on a bit of a rural tour in the coming weeks, seeing how people are doing out there in the ethanol industry and other industries that are impactful to the state of Iowa. And so we're going to sit and chat just a bit about who she is and what she believes, and maybe touch on business as well. Marianne, welcome to the Business News Hour. Nice to have you here.
Thank you so much.
You have an interesting history. Your father was an immigration attorney, yes. And you have been a businesswoman for a long time. Tell us about how did growing up in Houston, I believe it was, wasn't it? How did growing up in Houston, the child of an immigration attorney, and your business connection, how did all of that mesh? How did that come together? Are there impactful things that you learned from your family life in Houston that impacted you later in life as a business person?
I think the values of business are the values of personhood, to try to be a good person. I think righteous commerce is extremely important.
Righteous commerce, what is that?
Righteous commerce is when you see business as a win-win. That's the high side of capitalism. A win-win means, and for instance, my first business experience had to do with being an author. I've written 14 books. And authoring books is one of the last gentleman's businesses left. It's a win for all concerned. I put out a lot of energy writing a book. A publisher puts a lot of money and investment into the book, and then that translates into money then given by the person who buys the book, and what they get from it is the value of reading it. So everybody wins. And that because that is my first exposure to business, that is the template that I've always felt. So if I'm doing a seminar, or I'm leading, creating an online class, or I'm creating a book, it's the same thing. Everybody is to win. No one is to win at the expense of anyone else. I feel that's a value of God's universe. That's a value of love, that there's not a win-lose transaction. And so to me, it's the business of life that matters. And I've never thought of myself in that sense as a businesswoman. Now, if you're doing something where you're creating a product like a book or a class or a seminar that people come to and that people make money for, then by definition, you call it business. But I feel part of the degradation of our culture is that we have, over the last few decades, seen business as different from the rest of the business of life. We have separated business values from deep human values. And that, of course, started happening in the 1980s. When I was growing up, the corporation was expected to have a sense of moral and ethical responsibility that went beyond just fiduciary responsibility to the stockholder. More people were seen as stakeholders. The whole country is a stakeholder in what happens in corporate America. But that deviation from a sense of moral and ethical responsibility to worker, to community, to environment, has been a profound profound break with the best of us. It has turned us into an amoral economic system. I don't believe business and economics should be seen as separate from the rest of an ethical universe.
Marianne Williamson, ladies and gentlemen, we're talking about the world of business. You know, that is so accurate. It used to be that corporations had three goals. One was true to their employees, true to their community, and true to the investors. And today, the first two, it would seem to us, have left.
You know, it's been interesting, though, for me when I've talked in colleges and universities. There's a younger generation that is reclaiming what they call the three P's, people, profit, and planet. And that's very good. I think sometimes these young ones think they're coming up with something new. What they're really doing, of course, is claiming what was always considered true until this really very terrible aberrational time that began in the 1980s.
Yeah, and it has, I would argue, continued all the way to today's date.
That's just fact.
And you know, one of the things that we can talk about policy on this, one of the things was the Jobs and Tax Act that was put together by the president and the Congress that really did reward the top 1% of this nation and left behind so many others. Would you agree?
Almost everything that they do. Look at the 2017 tax bill. $2 trillion where 83 cents of every dollar goes to the very richest corporations and individuals. And why? We're still supposed to be buying into this canard that giving all the money to just a few people, then it will trickle down and lift all boats. It hasn't lifted all boats. It has left millions of people without even a life vest. You know, somebody was telling me here in about rural Iowa back in the 1980s.
Oh boy.
And I have heard this in other rural communities as well, analogies to this, how if a farmer didn't have a great year, the local bank worked with them. We'll cover you. We'll cover you because we know you'll have a better harvest next year. And then that stopped. That stopped. And same with a lot of rural communities. I remember I was talking to a Chamber of Commerce leader and mayor in a small town in South Carolina a few months ago, talking about how they used to get grants and loans that had more government grants with them in order to build up the local infrastructure, whether it's water, sewage, whatever, in order to make the community more attractive. But now there's a sense in business for the small business person, just as for the rest of the citizens, unless you're that small, small, tiny 1%, that the government is working to thwart you more than to help you. Like, we have turned the idea that the government is of, by, and for the people into some left-wing, radical, crazy socialist idea. And that's a terrible break from the best of who we are.
Marianne, you seem to be exceptionally kind. Is that going to play, you think, with voters?
Well, first of all, I have my moments as much as anybody does. So I'm afraid there's some people in my life who would be laughing the way you're laughing right now.
Well, good for you.
When I have a bad hour, I have a bad hour just like anybody else does. In terms of kindness playing with voters, in terms of my attitude towards life is certainly kind, and I certainly try my best to practice what I preach. Will it play? Yes. I believe that I have to believe in my heart. I have to believe in my heart that many of the people who voted for President Trump thought that his unkindness, I don't know, it's like they thought it was some joke or something, and that once he got in office, he wouldn't be that way. I don't know.
Yeah, it's...
I'm someone who finds it horrifying.
Marianne Williamson, ladies and gentlemen, let's turn our attention to something you mentioned just a bit ago. We were talking about rural Iowa. And rural Iowa is, for all intents and purposes, imploding right now. The farm income is down for the fifth or sixth year in a row. Commodity prices have tanked. The ongoing trade war with China has enabled other countries to step in, like Brazil, when we talk about soybean purchases. And so we're finding at an alarming rate, farmers in rural Iowa or rural Kansas or South Dakota or Minnesota, where people are leaving the farm or renting out their farm to larger consolidated people. So there's an issue of a quality of life that may very well be disappearing. What do you think?
There are primal values in human history, and the relationship between humanity and the earth and humanity and food is as basic as it gets. If you look back thousands and thousands of years, the relationship of humanity to the earth, the relationship of humanity to the food that is grown, government and economics should support those fragile bonds. And nature knows how to organize itself. Nature knows how to create an ecosystem, because nature is an ecosystem that works. Farmers carry, in many cases, what is ancient knowledge about seasons, about the earth, about food. And starting in the 1980s, just as in so many areas, the huge corporate conglomerates in this area, agribusiness, as we know, and that's tied to what I was talking about before, with the banks no longer working on the side of the average farmer. Here, I'll help you. You had a bad year, I'll help you. But we had an ecosystem. And notice how the natural ecosystem and the economic ecosystem were aligned. That's when life works. Life works in any segment of society when your economics is aligned with the natural order of things. And the natural order of things, when you're talking about food, you're talking about the earth, you're talking about the seasons, and you're talking about the role of the farmer, we're talking about going back thousands and thousands and thousands of years. An amoral economic system has no respect for any of that. An amoral economic system smashes through anything like that, almost with contempt, because it is amoral and therefore sociopathic. If you have an individual who just doesn't care about the needs of other people, that's a sociopath. And when you have an economic system that has no respect for the natural values of humanity, and our relationship to the earth is a natural value. You cannot mess with the earth and expect everything to be okay. You cannot mess with food production and expect everything to be okay. Maybe you, in alignment, because you have to be in alignment with some huge multinational corporate forces, are just sucking out of the system whatever short-term profits are possible at the moment. But you are leaving the trajectory of disaster to your children and to your grandchildren and to their children. So breaking, this is why anywhere, whether it has to do with agribusiness and the farmer or anywhere else, that these basically amoral corporate forces, for their own purposes, for no other reason than that they can, for no other reason than they have so much money. So they have so much money. You have government basically working as their handmaiden. And then you have the financial institutions, such as the banks, working on their side as well. This has devastated people. It has devastated land. And it has devastated our food production. We're already paying a high price for that. And just dealing with it on the level of the superficial policies, mm-hmm. I think that the superficial policies, this is to me, and this is one of the reasons I'm running, we have to do more than address the symptom. We have to address the cause. And so when it comes to agribusiness, like so many other areas, I thought we had antitrust laws in this country. I thought we were anti-monopoly. I'm all for returning this country back to its people. And the idea of the family farmer and the dignity of farming and the dignity. There was a wonderful book by a woman named Sarah Smarsh called Heartland, Working Hard and Going Broke in the Richest Country in the World. You might have read a book called Hillbilly Elegy.
Yes.
It's where he, what is his name, the author?
He's
can't remember.
From Ohio. Yeah.
Yeah. So he grew up.
He was here, as a matter of fact, in Des Moines not very long
right.
ago. Yeah.
And it's a book about growing up in white poverty in America. And then he became a high-minded conservative. She grew up in very similar circumstances and became a high-minded progressive. And it's fascinating.
How similar.
She's in Kansas.
Yeah. How similar their thoughts are.
But it is a beautiful and tragic portrayal of what happened within two generations of the farmer in the United States.
There was a study that was released by Iowa State University on the 22nd day of April. And this is what basically it said. In the 16 election, 2016, Iowa had more counties flip from Democrat to Republican than any other state in the nation. So these three sociologists said, let's go find out what the heck is going on out there in rural Iowa. So they went to these rural counties and sat down with voters who had cast their votes for the Republican candidate, Mr. Trump. And they thought perhaps the issues were going to be about economics, that the issues were going to be about about health care, things that really relate to their daily life and their daily living as far as economics go. But here's what they found out, and I thought it was very interesting, and I want you to comment on this if you can. They found that rural voters were more concerned about if brown people were coming to take their jobs or if a religion, whatever religion others were, others, that it didn't necessarily coincide with their religion, and that there was a fear among people that they were losing their way of life, which was really far more powerful, if you think about it, perhaps, than what economics are.
Well, first of all, part of that is economic, however, because if you're afraid that brown people are taking your job, that is economic, and there's a level of despair that leads to that. The second thing that's very disturbing there is that too many Americans are raised today without a profound educational grounding in the values of American democracy. If you're not taught the basic principles of the Declaration of Independence as a child, if you're not taught the basic core of the Bill of Rights as a child, then you don't know. You simply don't know as an adult to be horrified when the principles in those documents are transgressed against. So our Declaration of Independence says that all men are created equal. Our Declaration of Independence says that God gave all men inalienable rights of life and liberty in the pursuit of happiness, and that government's role is to secure those rights. Now, when we're children and we read, when we put our hands in front of our hearts and we pledge allegiance to the flag and liberty and justice for all, that's a pledge. It's not a guarantee. It's a pledge. And theoretically, it helps us become people who have a problem later in life if we see liberty and justice for all not happening. To me, these are core values that must be ingrained in us in childhood. And so anybody who is afraid, and it is a kind of psychic annihilation that some people fear. There are two categories of Americans right now. One category are those of us who go, wow, multicultural, multi-ethnic, multi-sexual, multi-religious diversity. How cool is that? Some of us white, some of us black, some of us brown, some of us gay, some of us straight, some of us Jewish, some of us Hindu, some of us Muslim, some of us Christian, some of us atheist, some of us Wicca, some of us atheist. Oh, this is so cool. And she's Turkish and he's Somali and she's from Ireland and this is just going to be amazing 50 years from now. Some of us see that as the full flowering of what this country was meant to be about. Others of us, particularly those who have been screwed and they know it, they know that their basic rights have been taken away. But basically, the forces that have taken them away, which is not the very poor, it's the very rich. It's like a thief. You know, it's like somebody who snatches a purse, and then the police come up and point, go, over there, I saw him, over there. So that's really what the game is. And so people have had that, which is actually the essential American flowering of the American dream, some have pointed to that so that the blame is displaced. And I heard Chris Matthews, TV journalist Chris Matthews, say something one night that really, really impacted me. He said he was talking to some blue-collar workers at a pub one night, and they were arguing about politics. And one of the men said to Chris Matthews, you know why this stuff matters to us so much? And Chris said, why? He said, it's all we've got. Hmm. That really, I thought, was really beautiful. So I think that there are people in this country who feel that their very identity is at risk of annihilation. Their very identity is at risk of annihilation because they were not told that our identity, our greater identity, and this is true spiritually, whether you're talking about a nation or not, our greater identity is our identity together. Our greater identity is our collective identity. When I relate to you, I am more of myself. When I have compassion for you and care about you, I am more of myself, not less of myself. But I can see where so much economic tension and anxiety has arisen in the lives of these people that I don't buy into that theoretically sociological theory that I know has become rather in over the last 2 years. Oh, it wasn't economics. Everything that then you said it is instead actually is economics.
And those people who feel left behind are
reacting
to that.
Well, they have been left behind. First of all, let's look at this. They have been left behind. People in the United States who felt in the last presidential election, the system is rigged and I wanted to change, were correct.
We heard that all the way.
And that's why it was going to be a populist cry of despair. That's why I believe it was going to be Trump or it was going to be Bernie. I don't think that Hillary Clinton cared less about these things, but she didn't name them. And people want to feel heard. People want to feel somebody understands here what I'm going through. So when her campaign was based on the idea that things are going so well, let's just continue with that. Millions of people felt, going so well, I'm drowning here.
Mm.
And there was a right-wing populist and a left-wing populist, but that populist cry of despair did not surprise me. It was going to come up from the bottom of things because there was so much despair.
Final question for Marianne Williamson. Marianne, what are you learning as you traverse the state of Iowa? What, other than what we've talked about, which is spot on, as a matter of fact, the economics of our state, but what are you learning from the people that you visit with at all of these stops? And I know this is just it's a rigorous adventure that you're on. It really, truly is. You didn't get in last night until very late. You were up very early this morning. This is what candidates do. What are you learning?
I'm not learning anything new so much as I'm learning something on a deeper level. We're really good people. Americans are good people. I'm not saying we're better than other people, because I don't think we are, but we are good people. And that's a big thing to be reminded of today, because our government is not leading with our goodness. So when I travel the country, and before I decided to run, I traveled throughout this country and did something I called the Love America Tour. Because after the president was elected, I wanted to see for myself, who are we? And I believe the average American is a good person. We're trying to live decent lives, take care of our families, do good in the world. The problem is that our deeper moral inquiry is circumscribed within the personal domain too much. We need to expand it. That's what citizenship is, where I'm asking these deeper questions, not only about my own life and my own family, but about the country. And I find in Iowa, but I also find this in New Hampshire and in South Carolina and Nevada, people take very seriously their role in this primary season. This is a big deal.
It is a big deal.
And people know it. And so I feel when people are listening to you, they know they're going to be listening to a lot of candidates, as they should. I think that's our civic responsibility. And it's a profound experience. A political campaign is a profound platform for having a conversation about things that matter. And people are deciding what attitudes and what consciousness will be represented by the person sitting behind the desk in the Oval Office. It doesn't get deeper and more important than that. What I find here is that people realize how important that is, and that's why it's such an honor to be in that process.
Marianne Williamson, candidate for President of the United States, thank you so much for sitting down and doing this.
Thank you so much.
Once again, that was Marianne Williamson, who is vying to become the candidate of the Democratic Party in the 2020 presidential election. We will have links to Marianne's website up on our radio blog. I got to tell you, I truly did enjoy that conversation. She's quite the insightful woman. All right, if you like what you hear, we do this every day, Monday through Friday, not only the business news, but also long-form business interviews like you've just heard. You can go ahead and subscribe to our podcast. All you have to do is Google Insight on Business, the News Hour, and yeah, we should be right there. Thanks for listening.